season with us, who is about all things balance.
I don't want to sleep when I die. Like, I want to sleep right now. Living a balanced, not busy life is over time. What is it that you're doing throughout your day to make you feel so balanced?
On today's episode of Corporate Homie,
we have a guest in the building, my personal financial advisor and friend, Jared Cohen, on the show. We're going to talk kind of all things money.
There was often times when I would go to them with an account, $150,000, they would tell me no. In general, you don't have to have a lot of money to have an advisor.
What's up, homies?
Hey, homies.
Welcome
hey,
back.
Homies.
Oh, yeah. Get in there. Yeah, I like it. That's right. Right off the bat. Yes. So as you can see, homies, we have a guest in the building, and he's a real homie. He's jumping right in. We are so delighted to have my personal financial advisor and friend, Jared Cohen, on the show. And we're going to talk kind of all things money and in general, and a little bit of money and pandemic today.
First you get the money, then you get the power, then you get the respect.
Oh, Lord. Money, power, respect. Money, power, respect. I don't need life. It's the key to life.
It's the key to life. I heard somebody tell me that. Yeah.
So that is what we're going to be talking about. Before we jump in and start asking you specific questions, Jared, tell us a little bit about your background and how you got into or developed your passion for financial advising and, more importantly, helping people with their goals.
Well, let me first say I appreciate y'all having me on the podcast and being able to speak to the homies. This is my first podcast interview.
Yeah.
So this is a great experience. But yeah, so I guess my little bit of my background. So it was my mom that actually got me interested in becoming a financial advisor back when I was an undergrad. She approached me, I think, my sophomore year at LSU. My parents had gone through a separation. She had this 401k lingering out there that had not been reviewed in 3 or 4 years since my parents separated. And she knew I was studying finance at LSU and ultimately just asked me to review it. At the time, I didn't even know what a 401k was. It's not like in college, they teach you about a 401k. It's not part of the curriculum. You know, there's no personal financial management courses. At least it wasn't when I was in school. And just like many other folks that graduate with different degrees, I'm studying finance and I don't know what a 401k is. And so I started doing a little bit of research, became interested. At the time, I think I was actually doing international finance, which is more of an economics degree. Then I switched my degree from international finance to just finance and wanted to hone in more on investing and personal financial management. And I thought to myself, well, if my mother, you know, doesn't know what this is, there has to be many other people out there like her who've been working for 20 plus years and needs advice. Right. And I thought that I could probably make a career out of it. And so I started managing her 401k account in college. And from there, I started managing some of her employees' 401k accounts because she would just, you know, talking to, hey, my son is doing this for me.
Hey, call my son. He can hook you up.
Right. And next thing you know, but when I graduated, I was managing 5 people's, you know, lifetime savings. And that's all they had.
That's
and
correct.
This is going into 2008. So it was interesting.
Oh, wow. Wow.
But nonetheless, that really set the foundation for me and really developed that passion of just helping people, wanting to add value, wanted to be of service to others. And ended up not getting a job doing that for a number of reasons after college, and took a job doing internal auditing with Deloitte & Touche in New York, and was miserable doing auditing. And then we're in the midst of a financial crisis. A woman named Cheryl Cruzo with Wealth Development Strategies in Houston gives me my start in the business. Black-owned firm, women-owned firm. I beg her for a shot and she gave me a shot. And that's how I got started.
That's awesome.
I love that. You were like, I was like, I'm going to shoot my shot, and it worked, and you've been at it ever since. So how long have you been officially, you know, in your professional capacity, a financial advisor?
11 years.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
That and is so
you,
crazy.
You're probably one of the few financial advisors that has like a decade or so of experience, but have been through like two huge financial crises.
That's right.
You got like the great,
that's right.
Now, how many people can say like, hey, I've got a decade of experience, but it includes the Great Recession and now a global pandemic.
That's right.
Right. Like, that's just a very unique thing to have to work through, you know.
And so that's right. Part of why we wanted you to come on the show. So, you know, one of the things that I know I've even been, you know, guilty of, and, you know, I'm sure you will say like, amen, when I say this, Jared, and Bimitra, but many times the homies, minorities and women feel as though you need to be rich before you have some type of advisor. And so if you're not, whatever rich even means, because I'm not even sure that what people think is rich is actually rich.
And they certainly don't have a number in their mind. They're just like, it's not me.
That's right.
Right. That's probably the first good place to start. Tell us a little bit about like who in general, right? Not necessarily your client even, Jared, but like who can benefit from working with a financial advisor?
I mean, the short story is everyone, truly, in a nutshell. But going back to my background, speaking about, you know, have to be rich to have an advisor, and also what really made me pivot from, you know, starting with a small, you know, local firm, moving over to Merrill Lynch, and dealing with those nuances. And then what really made me up and leave and start J.E. Cohen, my own firm, 5 years ago. But Merrill Lynch is exactly what, you know, you stated. No offense, I love Merrill. I love my experience that he taught me a lot. It really got me to where I am today. But Merrill Lynch says you have to have $250,000 of liquid assets before they will open an account. Yeah. Everyone has to get started somewhere. And so while I was there, I worked out a deal with them where I would bring in an account that had over $250,000 to start, but then they would let me slide in the account that maybe had $25,000 or $50,000 or $100,000 even for that matter. But there was often times when I would go to them with an account, $150,000, they would tell me, no, we're not going to open up this account. And so to your point about having to be rich or having to have money to have an advisor, depending on the platform or who you're trying to work with in terms of firm, that's absolutely true. But in general, you don't have to have a lot of money to have an advisor. There are several outlets out there now, especially given the tech revolution that we're currently in, where you can have ad hoc advisor when you need one, or when you can do something just purely online based and still get good counsel. You don't necessarily have to have an individual person that you can actually call on in today's world.
I think it's an important tip for the homies as well, because a lot of times, you know, people do workplaces that has a 401k or a 403b and they offer that service, but people are just not, you know, taking advantage of it. You know, the reality is in this pandemic, a lot of homies have had to take, you know, a pay cut, or there's no bonuses, or I know a lot of my banker friends, some of the bankers, they've just, the banks have said, hey, we're not going to do a sales plan this year, which means there's not going to be, if you don't have sales goals, you're not going to make a sales bonus, right? Can you talk a little bit about like, how do people, you know, kind of readjust? What should they be looking at budget-wise? What I've heard a lot of people say is like, hey, I don't really know where to start, because, you know, a lot of the homies are saying, hey, I don't really know where to get started, right? Mm-hmm. And I know like for me, if I'm trying to cut something out of my budget, I'm trying to cut material amounts, because then I can talk myself out of not cutting satellite radio, because I'm like, that $12 a month is not going to help me save money. Right. Like that's not going to be a game changer. Can you talk a little bit about how people should be approaching their household budgets given, because we don't know how long these pay cuts are going to last. We're in month 8 now. When we first did this, we were like, oh,
that's right.
We're trying to do this for a few weeks. Like we're 8 months in now. Yeah.
Well, that's right. And it really is a tough call because it's different for everyone. I mean, there is some general, you know, budgeting items that you should always keep in mind. But really, everyone is living through this pandemic in a very different circumstance than their neighbors. It's hard to compare yourself, and I would advise your listeners, the homies, not to do this, but try to compare yourselves to the homie sitting beside you or the family member or someone else that you just don't know their circumstances. But budgeting is always one of those things that is very personal. And the reason why is because people were raised in different environments, and it really stems from that in a way. Some people have just simply more discretionary means than others, and so they, you know, maybe have a little bit more of an aggressive budget than others. But generally speaking, one should try to figure out, okay, what are the necessary items that are must-haves, you know, that I just have to have, you know, rent, utilities, and things of that such. And then ultimately, okay, what are some things that I can build into the budget that are more discretionary in nature that I know I'm going to spend anyway because I know myself. I know I'm going to go buy Starbucks. I know I'm going to go shopping. I know I'm not going to cook. I know I'm going to eat out pretty regularly. Right. And just be honest with yourself about it.
So you get a plan for it and account for it. That makes sense.
Exactly. Exactly.
I love that. It's like, hey, I know I'm going to eat out, but I might not go get my nails done. You know.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. But and everyone's different about that.
Right.
Some people cook every day and hate eating out. And folks like myself.
And some people, their nails are the necessity.
That's right. That's right. Absolutely. For various reasons. Professional reasons, just personal, you know, care reasons. You know, be honest with yourself when it comes to budgeting, because it's you can read all the books, but it's not one and the same for everyone.
Well, that's right, because really I always think that when you think about Dave Ramsey, because he'll always be like, you know, don't have Starbucks. Don't, and I'm always like, well, yeah, right. I mean, that's not me. I'm not going to live that. I will do that for a period. I did want to say this. I read something one time years ago that always stuck with me that said, the average American adjusts to a pay raise within 2 pay periods. So they get a raise, they get paid the third time, they're already spending the money, that the additional money that they've earned, or, you know, figured out what to do with it. I won't say spending it, but they've adjusted. The average American, it takes them 5 years to adjust their lifestyle to a pay cut or a reduction. That's one thing I've been really thinking about with the homies, to Bemetra's point, is that we've been hearing from so many about, you know, having to adjust, do things that are different. And I wanted to talk a little bit about kind of you, because you hit on it, like, don't compare yourself. And what we just learned this term today, like money shame, that I definitely think we see, especially among millennials, because there's social media, and maybe everyone now, because you used to think you knew what the Joneses were doing, but now
you see it.
They're posting that they're doing a redoing their backyard, putting in a pool in the pandemic, or, you know, they just couldn't take it anymore, so they went to Fiji.
And, you know, for a month in the mountains, because I mean, who would stay in Florida in this heat when you're working from home? Everybody needs to get to North Carolina.
Right.
Yeah. Do you see that impacting how people deal with their money, that they're shameful or trying to keep up with the person next to them that's keeping people from making some, I won't say smart, but decisions that they might
be making the best decision for their household,
or not in line with what they're telling you their goals are. So have you had someone come and say, like, I want to retire at 50, and yet you're like, well, you can't retire at 50 because you're going to Fiji once a year?
I actually don't see that too often. I think given that a lot of the relationships that I work with, you know, either there's just been good coaching over the years, but I don't get a lot of those calls. And most of the calls that I get, especially for new relationships coming to me, has to do with questions surrounding, what is it that I'm not doing that I don't know that I should be doing?
Okay.
If that makes sense.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I remember when I was a very young professional, I didn't even understand when you guys would say things like you need $250,000 in asset. I thought that meant like in your savings account.
Right, not a combination of liquid investments, retirement assets.
I didn't know that meant your 401k, your 403b, the one you rolled over from your husband's, that all of that in the aggregate. And that sometimes people, even to hear that number, would say, I don't qualify. But then when they actually, if they've been working 15, 20 years, they actually easily have that number, but they don't know it because they don't know how to calculate it.
That's correct. But on the earlier point, you know, I used to always tell you, Demetra, and you remember this, I would always say, people you think that have a lot of money, that are making a lot of money, don't have any money.
I've been telling her that for years.
And one of the benefits of having an advisor versus not having an advisor is that an advisor sees a number of different families' financial pictures, for good or bad. Okay. If you're just trying to do things on your own, all right, and this is not a pitch for a financial advisor per se, as it is just think about it from the context. If you're just looking at your own picture and trying to make decisions based upon your own picture, you're very limited in scope as to, you know, what you can do, what you cannot do, what other people are doing that work, what other people are doing that hasn't worked. When you have an advisor, you know, again, that advisor is talking to a number of different families from different walks of life in very different professions. And what you think they may be doing based upon their own earnings could very well be because of an inheritance that they received. So they may be going to Fuji, for example, and you might be thinking, oh, well, I know I make more than that person. How are they going to Fiji? Or I said Fuji, I'm sorry. How are they going to Fiji? How are they going to Fiji? And I'm not going to Fiji.
Yeah, I think that's a really, really powerful point. I've seen this over the years. And I've also found that the people who did inherit the house or whose parents paid the 20% down on their house, whatever, they negate to mention that part, right?
That's like, right.
When they're talking.
That's so true.
We were actually just talking about that the other day because we were talking about someone that we admire greatly and they've had a career in public service, but they've also always had a nanny. And, you know, and so someone was like, well, how can they do that? And I thought, well, they're like the daughter of a third generation doctor. Right. Like only children of only children. Right. And I'm not sure that they actually pay for the nanny, right? Like, so they have a nanny, and because they have family who's able to help and assist, or like you said, or inheritance or something, whatever, there's another factor that, like, so you're just thinking, like, I work at the city, she works at the city, she, you know, we're both public service, I'm gonna go get me a nanny, and like you said, not even understanding.
I love what you said though. What I take from this and all this is, you know, everybody's financial picture is unique to them, right? There's no two families that's a light for a number of different reasons. And I think that's a great message for the homies to get. Everybody always says interest rates are low, like it's time to refinance.
Or buy if you've never bought.
Or purchase or, you know, what have you. Can you give us just kind of your thoughts on when is a good time to refinance?
Is it now?
You know, I've heard the 1% rule. You're not going to save. Can you just kind of give us, we're not going to hold you to it. Nobody's going to come back and say, well, Jared said this on y'all's podcast and now I'm mad. But just kind of I want to give that disclaimer, just your thoughts, you know, in general on when is a good time to refinance or to purchase.
Yeah, I mean, I hate to keep coming back to this, the default positioning, but it really is a case by case broadly. But, you know, more specifically, interest rates are lower. Cost of financing is lower. So it makes sense to try to take advantage of the times. If you want to upgrade your home, for example, if you want to do some renovations, upgrade meaning go buy something else. It makes sense to refinance if you haven't refinanced in a period. But there's a cost to refinancing every time as well. So you have to weigh the pros and cons of that in terms of how long do you plan to be in the home. I typically say only refinance if you believe that you're going to maintain ownership of this home for a period of time in excess of, I don't know, five years or more, just generally speaking, because it's going to take, you know, depending on the differential between your cost savings from the higher interest rate to the lower interest rate, a matter of months to a matter of years.
That I'm a little bit into that because I did that when I bought my first house, and it was on an arm. And when the arm was over, it shifted way down. Like it was a good time, mm-hmm. right? It wasn't like the horrible stories we heard of our parents. My mom and dad were like, don't get an arm, because they got an arm during the 80s. And then it shifted and it shifted way up. Well, it shifted way down. So then I thought, well, like, oh, it shifted way, because I don't know what I'm doing, right? It shifted way down. Let me go get into a fixed, right? Like now is the time to go get into a fixed. But to your point, I didn't think about like how much longer am I actually going to live here? And 18 months later, I was over it and ready to buy another house. And it just didn't make sense, right? It kind of all ended up being, you know, a wash. But in retrospect, I would have had, like you said, had that conversation with myself, like, yes, you're going to save this on the note and you're going to do this, but are you going to really save money if you're not going to live here another 5 years? And I think I knew then I wasn't going to be in there for five years, you know? So that's I only share that because I think sometimes the homies think we made all the right decisions. We did all the right things. And I want to share a time where I was like, yeah, looking back, I just wouldn't have done it that way.
When you see interest rates dropping the way they are, I think a healthy thing to do is reevaluate what you're wanting to do looking forward. And, you know, is it an absolute that you should refinance? Maybe not. But I definitely think it makes sense to just revisit your financial picture and say, does this make sense today for me to pursue this?
Right.
So having a financial advisor is such a personal relationship, right? You have such a personal relationship with your clients. Mm-hmm. How have you adjusted in this pandemic with keeping that personal touch where you're not necessarily able to get in the room with people? You know, this is the time of year, a lot of times you're doing your semi-annual meetings or what have you. Like, how's your practice changed in terms of how you touch and communicate with your clients?
You know, it's interesting. You would think that it would have changed drastically, but it really hasn't. The way I look at it is we just want to be available. You know, we want to make sure that we can maintain being a resource to our clients and to their family members and their friends and so forth. And I think just knowing that they have someone to call if they have any questions, I think goes over very well. And we have been fielding more calls from clients than we normally have. So you tend to kind of highlight your point. But we've been available consistently through the pandemic. First, when we were out of the office working from home, the entire office was working from home for a period. And then when we circled back to the office, nothing really changed terribly much. And so for us, it's just making sure that we're available, making sure that people know how to reach us. I think for the most part, every client that I have has my cell phone. So at the end of the day, they can reach me at all hours if they need to.
And they do.
That's what you heard.
One thing I want to talk about, we talk about this a lot on the podcast, that a lot of times the homies are very quick to try something they haven't tried for fear, like, people going to be in my business, right? You know, like, mm-hmm. I don't want to go to this Black doctor or this, you know, minority woman, whatever, because she's going to be, I might know her, she might know somebody I know, and she's going to be in my business. And I want to talk some about sort of the confidentiality or the confidential nature of what you do. And I had to say that to a friend of mine, even about her doctor, like, you do know that if you went to the doctor and she told people your business, that is violating the Hippocratic
Oath.
Like, so like, do you think she's unethical? So I want you to talk a little bit about that, because I think that also ends up being a barrier, because people, like I said, have money shame. They have more credit card debt than people know, or they do have student loans. They just don't want. And so I want to talk about that, since sometimes keeps people from getting there.
No, right. That's a great point. You know, I think I'm a great example of what you're talking about, because many of my friends and family members are clients of the firm. Mm-hmm. And that's actually slightly different than other advisors. Mm-hmm. I recall being at Merrill Lynch, and the last thing they wanted to do was work with their friends and family members. And what I always suggested was, I feel like I'm the best person, the best resource to take care of my friends and family, because I love them, I trust them, they trust me. And so that kind of relationship bodes very well in a financial advisory capacity. But to your point, I never talk about other friends or other family members or anything. I mean, this is very sensitive information that we're dealing with and very personal information that we're dealing with. And I don't think anyone would appreciate their business being shared with other parties, you know, aside from some type of legal capacity where I'm, you know, required to do so. Right. And I've never been in that type of situation in the 11 years that I've been doing this. And so I think there is definitely a confidence that has been established where I don't have many questions surrounding that. I mean, and that's evident. I get a number of referrals from clients to their friends and to their family members, their parents. And, you know, one of my biggest source of clients when I first started was actually my friend's parents, because my friends were so young. I was 22 when I started in the business. We didn't have any money. Right. and so
it was nothing to advise.
Yeah, right. There was nothing to advise. And my friends didn't have, you know, any resources aside from the ones that were professional athletes. That was mm-hmm. an aspect of my practice when I first started. And so aside from them, I didn't have the professional relationships having just graduated from college, you know, to be able to leverage. And so really it was my friends' parents. And so it started very early for me to establish those relationships. And I've carried over, you know, for 11 years now.
Jerry, can you share a little bit about how you work with other professionals to help your clients, whether that be private bankers or real estate
Oh, sure.
or
their
attorney?
Definitely.
You know, can you share a little bit about like how you guys come to assist as a team?
Yeah, you know, no, that's exactly right. It is a village. Homies come to the firm or come to me for not just investment related questions, but really just financial related questions. And more times than not, I cannot help them directly. For example, we don't do estate planning in-house. That's something that we refer out to our partners that we work with. When someone wants to refinance a home, as we were talking about earlier, you know, we have banking relationships that we can refer people to and have done that plenty of times, where we kind of quarterback the referral, quarterback their circumstance, give advice surrounding, do we think they should do an ARM? Do they think we should do it? Do we think they should do a fixed rate product? If they plan on being in the home for less than 10 years, you know, do we do something that's a little bit more short-term in nature? We absolutely work with other advisors and other bankers to your point, to help facilitate their needs. And I think any great advisor has to have a roster of people that they trust they can afford their people to take care of them. Because, you know, I'm sure many homies have had experiences with, you know, not all apples are good. And so, and especially in our community, there's a big distrust of financial advisors or financial professionals in general, just due to the history of things that's happened over the years. And I mean, we're going back to redlining, you know, right. well before right. we were even here. I mean, this is a carried forward,
and
you know, concern.
It's not old. I mean, you know, we've had national banks, you know, Wells Fargo.
That's right. More recently. That's right.
In the last 3 years, who've
that's
had to
correct.
Pay money.
And then people see their favorites.
We so were much. Charging more money to black and brown people for the same.
That's exactly right.
That's right.
As I like to remind people, financial discrimination is not a thing of the past.
That's very
it's
true.
Present tense, you know?
No, it's very true.
And you couple that with, you know, people seeing their favorite athlete filing bankruptcy because his financial advisor put something in and took money. I just think you combine all that. That's why I said I think we sort of as a community have a general distrust, which I find keeps us financially locked out, right?
That's
because
right.
then we're hesitant to do any type of investing. We're hesitant to do anything. And I find that my colleagues that are not minorities are the opposite. They do have sort of a threshold of, you know, even if it's something as small as something like, okay, I know I can invest $30,000 and I'll try. Mm-hmm. You say $30,000 to somebody, they'll be like, are you okay? You're like, okay,
you
well, what, right. Well, what number right, are you comfortable
right,
with? What
right.
number are you comfortable with? And
right.
they don't have a number. So I'm curious about how you work to overcome that. Or do you just think they're not ready for me to work with and I wait till they get ready? Or is it if we have homies who are listening who think, I'm not doing anything yet. I did my own 401k. I've never done anything. Like, what would you say mm-hmm. to them to make them think about, like, here's a way to start opening up that dialogue or softening your heart to the situation?
You know, that's a really, really great question and a tough question. And it's my experience is such that it's not easy at all. I have to work oftentimes much harder to land someone to open to earn their business in our community than I do otherwise. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is because of that general distrust. You know, am I like the person who used to knock on the doors and try to sell you some bogus life insurance product?
Right.
You know, I'm not that guy. We're not that kind of firm. You know, what I try to do to demonstrate trustworthiness is really in confidence, especially is just use logic. I try to educate people. Mm-hmm. You know, I try to impart information to them that is unbiased, and also in terms of from an advice standpoint that I feel like is truly in their best interest from analyzing their circumstances. And I think, as you guys know, and I think the homies know, most people can sense when they're being sold something and when there's someone truly endearing and truly, you know, has their best interest at heart. And I just try to be sincere in my counsel and my advice, and that's what I impart to my team. And I think that's what's carried over for the last, you know, 11 years that I've been able to do this. I think if I wasn't able to instill that type of confidence and trust, people wouldn't work with me, people wouldn't refer me, and then ultimately I wouldn't have a business to run. I found that, especially in our community, if we're going to speak on that, people have heard what they need to do for a long time. It's not foreign.
Right.
They've heard that they need to be an investor, for example, not just a saver. Okay. But the question becomes, how do you invest?
How do you do that?
How do you do that? Right.
How do you even get started? Yeah.
And that's just due to not having those conversations at the dinner table growing up because of the distrust that's carried over in the community and things like that. You know, most of the time when I explain that this is how you do it, and this is how people have been doing it, and this is how it works, and these are the benefits, these are the concerns, the risks that's associated with investing, most people tend to move forward, I found.
That's so interesting. I have a client that runs a woman-owned real estate investment fund, and she was telling me, this is like, it's been during the pandemic, that if she has like a $50,000 opportunity, right? Like it's a $50,000 to get in. Most of the time, if she asks men, they're either like, send me the stuff. Yes, no, they're in, they're out. If she sends it to women, they have to deliberate so much longer. And they often are like, I need to ask my husband. And I thought that was, I don't know, that just struck me as very, I felt a little conflicted about it. On one hand, I'm like, well, $50,000 is kind of, let's say, the price of a super, super nice car. And most people, I think, in our community would not buy a car without discussing it with their spouse.
Mm-hmm.
But lots of people have $50,000 cars.
That's right.
And that's a depreciating asset. So it just really made me think about, like you said, our just sort of fear of getting past, getting into the investment game.
Well, that $50,000 car, they're paying for a few hundred dollars a month. They're not having to let go of $50,000 at once.
That's right. Yeah.
So there's that component as well.
Yeah. Right. Jared, is there anything that you didn't get out or get a chance to share that you want the homies to know? Or, I mean, this has been such good, rich information, I think, for people. Like I said, the biggest takeaway I took is, you know, we talk about this all the time, run your own race, you know, don't compare yourself against other people because you don't know if you're all playing from the same hand.
You know, earlier on, you talked about, you know, the homies feeling like they have to be rich to have an advisor and to get good advice and different things. And rich is so relative.
That's what I said. What is rich?
What is rich? That's exactly right. I'll tell you, my mother is a great example of this. I once told my mother, I was like, Mom, you know, you really need to contribute more to your retirement account because you need to have X amount of dollars in retirement, you know, and so forth and so forth. And we got to a certain goal that we had set. And she was like, all right, well, I'm going to reduce my contributions. I'm good. And I said, Mom, you know, you got to keep investing. You got to keep contributing the money. She was like, no, we hit the number. We're good.
We hit the number.
And then I sit there forever.
I've seen other people that have had $7 million in net worth, I mean, actual assets. And they're like, hey, we just don't have enough. Like we're just out here working hard. You know, you're like, wait a minute, you got $7 million. You know?
Oh, yeah. Let me tell you.
It is all relative.
Oh, right? Yeah. Let me tell you, like, on that point, I'm just to let you know how your interests, it changes over time as you build wealth. You know, there's a family that I sat down with a few years ago, and they had about $10 to $11 million liquid, And this family felt like they weren't wealthy at all because they couldn't go and donate $500,000 without needing. Their lifestyle was such that they needed every penny of that money to live their lifestyle. And the idea of being philanthropic and giving away that kind of money.
They probably are. People like that.
but the thing is, to your point, because they couldn't be philanthropic like their friends, they didn't feel rich.
Right.
So I mean, it's all so relative that I really try to impart that upon families and individuals, because it really is a case by case. I really can't drive that home anymore than I
well have. We really appreciate you hanging out and sharing with the homies today. I hope the homies realize, like, it's never too late to get started. I think you know, one of the things I took is, like, just getting started, like you said, contributing to your 401k, whatever. I feel like those t-shirts that says, you know, that shows, like, or the memes you see where you see, like, this morbidly obese person on the track and they're like, hey, you're still lapping everybody that's on the couch, right? So even mm-hmm. if you're listening to this and you're like, I don't have $1 saved, I'm not contributing to my 401k, like, you can start doing that your next pay period, right? Like, there's right. no rules. Absolutely. Like, you just got to give up forever and ever, amen. Like, you just get started now. Tell the homies where they can find you, like, whether it's you know, your website, or if you've got social media handles. Let the homies know where they can find you, Jared.
Yeah, absolutely. Our website is www.jecohenholdings.com. It's currently under construction, but you can definitely still reach us through that site. It has all of our contact information there. You could also find us through our Facebook group or Facebook account, J.E. Cohen, and LinkedIn pages. And then also my personal Instagram is just my name, Jared Cohen.
J-A-R-R-E-T-T.
C-O-H-E-N. That's right. I would like to leave a little bit of advice if it's not too late. Is it okay to do that?
Absolutely.
Okay. Two things. Oftentimes people associate, what I found in my career is they associate saving with investing, and it's two very, very different things. Savings is something that I think everyone knows they need to do. And investing is something they feel is optional. Really isn't. It's absolutely necessary. As the saying goes, the earlier to start, the better off you are. And it's not even so much how much you contribute. It's just a matter of how early you start. And the earlier you start, the less you need to contribute, you know, on an annual basis, monthly basis, to accumulate, you know, a good source of wealth in the future. But the later you start, the more you have to play catch up and the more you have to contribute. And so why make it hard for yourself? Just start contributing as early as you possibly can. And even if you didn't start contributing in your 20s or your 30s or your 40s, if you're contributing in your 50s, you still are better off for doing it than not having done it. The other thing I want to say is, I oftentimes get questions, and this is not so much pandemic related as much as it is, what do I do with student loans? I have a really interesting thought about student loans that I thought that I would share with you guys, share with the homies.
Okay.
My personal view about student loans is very similar to how mortgages and home ownership is a foundational tool for wealth building. I personally believe that student loans is a foundational asset, not a liability, a foundational asset for building wealth, because had someone not had, you know, those student loans to further their education, they wouldn't be making the earnings that they're making and be able to have the discretionary means to save and invest and do all the things and have a better quality of life. And so because we're in a situation where student loan debt is at an all-time high, I believe the paradigm has shifted, where I believe people need to begin looking at student loans from the standpoint of, how does the student loans affect my net worth? And so most people think, okay, if my student loans have X amount of interest rate and this kind of payment, am I able to invest that money and generate a higher interest rate? Thus, if I can't do that, then I should be paying down my debt. I don't necessarily agree with that. I believe that student loans should be treated like mortgages and that they should take a long time to be paid off. I don't actually believe that student loans should be accelerated to be paid off. And the reason why is because if you think about a mortgage, stay with me here if you can, and hopefully this isn't too granular, but if you think about a mortgage, there's only one other case where the government or the system, the financial system, is built upon building wealth and giving you a lot of money before you really, you know, deserve it. And that is a mortgage. We think about it, they'll loan you up to 95% of the purchase price for a home because they're under the thought that that home will appreciate over time. Well, the government gives you all this money for student loans. The government knows that student loans is a wealth building tool. And they know that with student loans, you're more than likely going to make more money had you not taken out those students and advanced your career. Mm-hmm. And so if they're willing to do that, it makes a lot of sense. And I'm happy to talk to individuals directly about this, but it makes a lot of sense to actually carry the loans and pay them off slowly. Mm-hmm. Actually take the difference, the money that you're making.
And invest it in the market.
Exactly.
Yeah, and it's unsecured debt. Like, why would you want to pay that off?
Well, and that's a great point. And I think that's the kind of things that we typically in our community don't know. I know it wasn't until you and I were even really working together. Mm-hmm. I was always under the impression, like, get all your debt paid off. Don't have a mortgage. Don't have a student. And then you start thinking, like, okay, well, wait, what's the interest rate on the house? Wait, what's mm-hmm. the interest rate on? Like, it's not just, you know, a zero-sum game. We had a lot of student loans. I mean, thank the Lord, we both have sure. paid ours off, but we took a fair amount of time to do so.
Sure.
And, you know, we're 20-something years into our career.
We were blessed to get scholarships to school. There were so many people, they had to finance every dollar of their education.
And we didn't. Were blessed enough That's to a great have, point.
Some undergraduate scholarship dollars, yeah.
But we always have sort of said what you said, Jared, which is, but for this MBA, this JD, I wouldn't have the ability to make the income. So I don't begrudge this debt like other people do. Like, I'm not gonna let the debt shame me or make me feel badly because it's how I got this good job, as my grandmother would say. That's how I got this good job.
That's right. That's right. But you know, the stock market has quadrupled since 2009. And you have to ask yourself, had you not put that money towards the debt, to accelerate paying it off. And of course, hindsight is 2020.
Yeah.
Right.
Where would that money be today?
Be. Right.
How would it have grown? And it's just a thought, but my general line thinking is that if the government is willing to finance you
let
for your
them.
Education, let them.
Right, so you're talking about federal loans. That's a good word. So it's like
a great parting advice. Yeah.
That's what I'm about to say. So we've left with some really good tips. We really appreciate you taking some time out.
No, thank you for having me.
This has been great. And you know, if we get any questions, we'll certainly, you know, reach out to you directly. But we just want to say thanks again. And
no,
we'll
thank you.
Hope you have enjoyed the show.
I have.
Hustle hard, homies.
Get you a twin. Get you another homie.